We're in the middle of the Motives of Devotion, this essay by Sri Aurobindo that was published in the Arya on the 15th of May, 1918. We had got to a midpoint in the chapter. And he's going to describe now the various relations that the real human soul can have with the real divine using bhakti yoga as the touchstone by which we come into that. But not that as an impersonal reality, because this conscious being is the great person, is Purushottama, the supreme, the ultimate person. Sri Aurobindo begins this section here. Even if the supreme be capable of relations with us, but only of impersonal relations, religion is robbed of its human vitality, and the path of devotion ceases to be effective or even possible. Remember, in the previous paragraph, he has shown to us what it looks like if you're approaching an impersonal reality, if you're approaching a being that's abstracted from the cosmos, if you're approaching something in whom only oneness exists, and where is there room for a lover or a beloved? And is this failure to find a real entity an indication that only a void truly is there? That shunya, emptiness, is the end of every experience? So for Sri Aurobindo, this is unsatisfying. This does not answer to his greatening experience from 1909 to 1910 and beyond, which was the foundation of his yoga. That, yes, one can be free of egoistic fixity and still find a reality that is not only searchable, seekable, but is the very source of your being here. And that that same reality is stationed omnipresently. It is everywhere. It is the only thing that is, and it can never go out of existence. So to try to dissolve things into an emptiness or into a blank, whited-out state in which you no longer exist, and that no longer exists because everything is sheer and immaculate, does not correspond to what he was seeking to achieve in an integrated way. To make all of these states the state in which you are free from fixity to form, in which you are fulfilling yourself as the soul spark of that Supreme Person moving endlessly in a figure of growth, a greatening truth in yourself, emulating step by step, capturing step by step all the possibilities that exist inside the Supreme, who dances out the enormity of existence as Nataraj, and yet remains unmoved, completely absorbed in that conscious state. Manifest, unmanifest. Cosmic, individual. Aware of you, leading you, guiding you, delivering you to your self-chosen destination. Just as you chose to come here, your return is as sure if you wish it. So the divine says to us, what would delight you? And we find in every experience through life, at the core of that experience, a deep satisfaction, even behind abject suffering, there is that conscious being who is undisturbed, full of felicity, and willing to go through it, to get beyond it, to get to the illimitable, which this small figuration seems to suggest is our work. So let's read that again. Even if the Supreme be capable of relations with us, but only of impersonal relations, religion is robbed of its human vitality and the path of devotion ceases to be effective or even possible. We may indeed apply our human emotions to it, but in a vague and imprecise fashion with no hope of a human response. The only way in which it can respond to us is by stilling our emotions and throwing upon us its own impersonal calm and immutable equality. Calm, shama, equality, samatha. And this is what in fact happens when we approach the pure impersonality of the Godhead. We can obey it as a law, lift our souls to it in aspiration towards its tranquil being, grow into it by shedding from us our emotional nature. The human being in us is not satisfied, but it is quieted, balanced, stilled. But the yoga of devotion, agreeing in this with religion, insists on a closer and warmer worship than this impersonal aspiration. It aims at a divine fulfillment of the humanity in us as well as of the impersonal part of our being. It aims at a divine satisfaction of the emotional being of man. It demands of the Supreme acceptance of our love and a response in kind. As we delight in him and seek him, so it believes that he too delights in us and seeks us. Nor can this demand be condemned as irrational, for if the supreme and universal being did not take any delight in us, it is not easy to see how we could have come into being or could remain in being. And if he does not at all draw us towards him, a divine seeking of us, there would seem to be no reason in nature why we should turn from the round of our normal existence to seek him. Remember in our early chapters in the Synthesis of Yoga, how Sri Aurobindo suggests that he who chooses the infinite has been chosen by the infinite. That there's this old adage that the gods in their celestial realms are always watching humanity to see who is awake, who is ready, who wants to grow more, who can accept the surcharge of my illumination and power. So says a Godhead to an aspiring humanity. There's a poem called The Hound of Heaven, written by Sir Francis Thompson. Somebody said to Sri Aurobindo, he's not such a great poem, it's the only great thing he ever wrote. And Sri Aurobindo said, a poet who has written a great poem is, by very definition, a great poet. If you haven't read that, it describes how the human spirit struggles to get away from God. God is watchful over us and calls us to, and we resist and find every means by which to push him off, to elude his grasp, and finally, the divine captures us. And it is our greatest happiness, and it is utter liberation, because that thing which we think we seek in the world can only be found in the eternal, who masks itself in all these disguises in the world. So, if then you can turn around and live seeking the divine in every experience and in every form that seems to hide it, even the ugliness, even the indifferent, now you're on to something, and the great game begins. You will never be bored. Sri Aurobindo continues, therefore, that there may be at all any possibility of a yoga of devotion, we must assume first that the supreme existence is not an abstraction or a state of existence, but a conscious being. And indeed, this conscious being begins to describe what is that great culmination of Vedantic thought, Satchit Ananda, which is the very core of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy, that there is a real being, a sat. There is consciousness, which is equally real, which is identical with sat, and that Ananda is the nature of that conscious being. And this concept appears not in the sterile philosophy of Mayavada. No, it appears in theistic Vedanta, first describing the Godhead as a personal being. And then, why just he? It appears in the Shakti tradition as she. She is Satchit Ananda Rupani. So, however you conceive, that reality comes to you. We'll come to that in a minute. As it's coming to us, we'll come to it. So first, a conscious being. Secondly, that he meets us in the universe and in some way, and is in some way immanent in it, as well as its source. Otherwise, we should have to go out of cosmic life to meet him. So, whatever this conscious being is, beyond the partitions of time and space, beyond the definitions that dominate our experience, whatever it may be in the abstract, it's here. It is the here and the now. It is the past. It is the future. All is bound in that. So, the world, in a sense, is dripping with divinity. There is nothing at which you can point, in which the divine essence isn't there, but also embedded in the form. That essence supports the form, and the form is a mere figuring of what it is, but is a real figuring, however shape-shifting it might be. Thirdly, that he is capable of personal relations with us and must therefore be not incapable of personality. So this relationship, there and here. Finally, that when we approach him by our human emotions, we receive a response in kind. So there's a conscient being. There is a truth of its presence here in the universe. It relates to to all conscious beings who populate the universe. And the power of reciprocation is there. And we find this in the Shandilya Bhakti Sutras as well, verses 93-94. Unity is its nature. Souls are not separate from the Supreme. Quote, this does not mean that the nature of the divine is precisely the same as our human nature, though upon a larger scale, or that it is that nature pure of certain perversions and God, a magnified or else an ideal man. God is not and cannot be an ego limited by his qualities as we are in our normal consciousness. But on the other hand, our human consciousness must certainly originate and have been derived from the divine, though the forms which it takes in us may and must be other than the divine, because we are limited by ego, not universal, not superior to our nature, not greater than our qualities and their workings as he is. Still, our human emotions and impulses must have behind them a truth in him of which they are the limited and very often, therefore, the perverse or even the degraded forms. By approaching him through our emotional being, we approach that truth. It comes down to us to meet our emotions and lift them towards it. Through it, our emotional being is united with him. So what seems to be the very figuration of our limitations becomes the means by which we are delivered into that consciousness, by which we become one with the Supreme. Secondly, this Supreme Being is also the universal being, and our relations with the universe are all means by which we are prepared for entering into relation with him. So this is all a beautiful, large stagecraft. All the emotions with which we confront the action of the universal existence upon us are really directed towards him. In ignorance at first, but it is by directing them in growing knowledge towards him that we enter into more intimate relations with him. And all that is false and ignorant in them will fall away as we draw nearer towards unity. And again, back to the Shandilya Bhakti Sutras, to quote, this is the third section, verse 1, I think. This visible world is not different from the divine, and all is his manifestation. Conscious growth towards oneness. From the near to the far, from the small to the large, from the limited to the illimitable. To all of them, he answers, taking us in the stage of progress in which we are. Echo of the Gita. For if we met no kind of response or help to our imperfect approach, the more perfect relations could never be established. Even as men approach him, so he accepts them and responds to, by the divine love, to their bhakti, tataiva bhajate. And of course, this is Bhagavad Gita, the fourth chapter, the 11th verse, shloka. As men approach me, so I accept them to my love, bhajami. Also, look at the Gita, chapter 6, shloka 47. Shraddhavan bhajate yo mam, who partakes of me with faith. Whatever form of being, whatever qualities they lend to him, in other words, we create in our minds the qualities that God must wear, and he agrees to wear that dress, that garb, because it suits us. Ishta Devata. Whatever form of being, whatever qualities they lend to him, through that form and those qualities, he helps them to develop, encourages or governs their advance, and in their straight way or their crooked, draws them towards him. And that's Gita, chapter 3, shloka 33. What they see of him is a truth, but a truth represented to them in the terms of their own being and consciousness, partially, distortedly, not in the terms of its own higher reality, not in the aspect which it assumes when we become aware of the complete divinity. And that's the Gita, 7:23 and 7:24. But while we're going through the seventh chapter, which, by the way, is the Yoga of Knowledge, isn't it interesting that Sri Aurobindo in the Yoga of Knowledge finds perfect consonants for the Yoga of Devotion? In the seventh chapter of the Gita, the 21st verse, whatever form of me, my devotee with faith desires to worship, I make that faith of his firm and undeviating. So, however small a path it may seem, it is a path that will lead directly to the divine as long as there is sincerity, as long as there is self-giving, as long as one attaches oneself to it. Bhajate. Bhaj means to partake, to share, to connect to. And by association, it means devotion. So it means, I will cling to you. Mother said, cling to truth. If you cling to truth, you come to her. It will lift you out of all embarrassing circumstances and deliver you whole and pure into the lap of the divine, because it demands integrity to cling to truth. Wholeness of being. One part of you will purify another part of you, and all will travel together and arrive in her lap. This is the justification of the cruder and more primitive elements of religion, and also their sentence of transience and passing. They are justified because there is a truth of the divine behind them, and only so could that truth of the divine be approached in that stage of the developing human consciousness and be helped forward. They are condemned because to persist always in these crude conceptions and relations with the divine is to miss that closer union towards which these crude beginnings are the first steps, however faltering. So yes, however you begin, it's a good beginning. And don't be afraid to stride beyond, to keep going. All life, we have said, is a yoga of nature. Here in this material world, life is her reaching out from her first in conscience towards a return to union with the conscient divine from whom she proceeded. So we're back to basically the opening mantra of the synthesis of yoga. All life is yoga. In religion, the mind of man, her accomplished instrument, becomes aware of her goal in him, responds to her aspiration. Even popular religion is a sort of ignorant yoga of devotion. But it does not become what we specifically call yoga until the motive becomes, in a certain degree, clairvoyant, until it sees that union is its object and that love is the principle of union, and until, therefore, it tries to realize love and lose its separative character in love. So he used the term clairvoyant. Let's stop and look at that for a moment, because it has all sorts of occult associations with it in popular usage. It's a French word, clair, in Latin clarus, which means clear, and then voir, which in Latin is videre, to see. So really it means the power to see things beyond sensory presentation. In other words, to see concealed realities, to see behind the surface, to penetrate the appearance and get to the substance. That's what clairvoyance really is. When that has been accomplished, then the yoga has taken its decisive step and is sure of its fruition. Thus, the motives of devotion have first to direct themselves engrossingly and predominantly towards the divine, and then to transform themselves so that they are rid of their more earthy elements, and finally to take their stand in pure and perfect love. So aspire, transform, and then fix a new form. All those that cannot coexist with the perfect union of love must eventually fall away, while only those that can form themselves into expressions of divine love and into means of enjoying divine love can remain. For love is the one emotion in us which can be entirely motiveless and self-existent. Love need have no other motive than love. For all our emotions arise either from the seeking after delight and the possession of it, or from the baffling of the search, or from the failure of the delight we have possessed or had thought to grasp. But love is that by which we can enter directly into possession of the self-existent delight of the divine being. Divine love is indeed itself that possession, and as it were, the body of the Ananda. Mother had an expression that she used with the children in the playground about the various gradations of love. The lowest is, you love me, and I'll see if I love you. The second was, if you love me, I'll agree to love you too. And the third, I'll love you whether you love me or not. But the highest was, I simply love. Divine love is indeed itself that possession, and as it were, the body of the Ananda, the pulsating form of delight. These are the truths which condition our approach to this yoga and our journey on this path. There are subsidiary questions which arise and trouble the intellect of man, but though we may have yet to deal with them, they are not essential. Yoga of bhakti is a matter of the heart and not of the intellect. For even for the knowledge which comes on this way, we set out from the heart and not from the intelligence. The truth of the motives of the heart's devotion and their final arrival and in some sort their disappearance into the supreme and unique self-existent motive of love is therefore all that initially and essentially concerns us. Such difficult questions there are as whether the divine has an original supraphysical form or power of form from which all forms proceed or is eternally formless. All we need at present say is that the divine does at least accept the various forms which the devotee gives to him and through them meets him in love. While the mixing of our spirits with his spirit is essential to the fruition of bhakti. So whether you call that contact, or you call it communion, or you call it identity, that is real and you seek it, and when you touch it, you know what is real. So too, certain religions and religious philosophies seek to bind down devotion by a conception of an eternal difference between the human soul and the divine, dvaita, without which they say love and devotion cannot exist, while that philosophy which considers that one alone exists, advaita, consigns love and devotion to a movement in the ignorance, necessary perhaps, or at least useful as a preparatory movement while yet the ignorance lasts, but impossible when all difference is abolished and therefore to be transcended and discarded. We may hold, however, the truth of the one existence in this sense, that all in nature is the divine, even though God be more than all in nature. And love becomes then a movement by which the divine in nature and man takes possession of and enjoys the delight of the universal and the supreme divine. In any case, love has necessarily a twofold fulfillment by its very nature. That by which the lover and the beloved enjoy their union in difference, and all too that enhances the joy of various union, and that by which they throw themselves into each other and become one self. That truth is quite sufficient to start with, for it is the very nature of love, and since love is the essential motive of this yoga, as is the whole nature of love, so will be too the crown and fulfillment of the movement of the yoga. That concludes the chapter. And I have a passage marked in Savitri, the bliss of communion described here, of aspiration and the insistence on the collective fulfillment. This is in Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day, the Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. And we start on page 685. On Savitri, listening in her tranquil heart to the harmony of the ensnaring voice, a joy exceeding earth's and heaven's poured down, the bliss of an unknown eternity, a rapture from some waiting infinite. A smile came rippling out in her wide eyes, its confident felicity's messenger, as if the first beam of the morning sun rippled along two wakened lotus pools. Oh, besetter of man's soul with life and death, and the world's pleasure and pain and day and night, tempting his heart with the far lure of heaven, testing his strength with the close touch of hell, I climb not to thy everlasting day, even as I have shunned thy eternal night. To me, who turn not from thy terrestrial way, give back the other self my nature asks. Thy spaces need him not to help their joy. Earth needs his beautiful spirit made by thee to fling delight down like a net of gold. Earth is the chosen place of mightiest souls. Earth is the heroic spirit's battlefield, the forge where the archmason shapes his works. Thy servitudes on earth are greater, King, than all the glorious liberties of heaven. The heavens were once to me my natural home. I too have wandered in star-jeweled groves, paced sun-gold pastures and moon-silver swards, and heard the harping laughter of their streams, and lingered under branches dropping myrrh. I too have reveled in the fields of light, touched by the ethereal raiment of the winds. Thy wonder rounds of music I have trod, lived in the rhyme of bright, unlaboring thoughts. I have beat swift harmonies of rapture vast, danced in spontaneous measures of the soul, the great and easy dances of the gods. Oh, fragrant are the lanes thy children walk, and lovely is the memory of their feet amid the wonder flowers of paradise. A heavier tread is mine, a mightier touch. There, where the gods and demons battle in night, or wrestle on the borders of the sun, taught by the sweetness and the pain of life to bear the uneven, strenuous beat that throbs against the edge of some divinest hope, to dare the impossible with these pangs of search, in me the spirit of immortal love stretches its arms out to embrace mankind. Too far thy heavens for me from suffering men. Imperfect is the joy not shared by all. Oh, to spread forth, oh, to encircle and seize more hearts till love in us has filled thy world. Oh, life, the life beneath the wheeling stars. For victory in the tournament with death, for bending of the fierce and difficult bow, for flashing of the splendid sword of God. O thou who sound'st the trumpet in the lists, part not the handle from the untried steel, take not the warrior with his blow unstruck. Are there not still a million fights to wage? O Kingsmith, clang on still thy toil begun. Weld us to one in thy strong smithy of life. Thy fine curved jeweled hilt call savitri. Thy blade's exultant smile name Satyavan. Fashion to beauty. Point us through the world. Break not the lyre before the song is found. Are there not still unnumbered chants to weave? Oh, subtle-souled musician of the years, play out what thou hast fluted on my stops. Arise from the strain their first wild playing divined, and that discover which is yet unsung. I know that I can lift man's soul to God. I know that he can bring the immortal down. Our will labors, permitted by thy will, and without thee, an empty roar of storm, a senseless whirlwind is the Titan's force, and without thee, a snare, the strength of gods. Let not the inconscient gulf swallow man's race, that through earth's ignorance struggles towards thy light. O thunderer, with the lightnings of the soul, give not to darkness and to death thy son. Achieve thy wisdom's hidden firm decree, and the mandate of thy secret worldwide love. Oh, I think we must continue that passage. Namaste. Jai Ma.